Few could explain, let alone seek out a career in criticism. Yet what A.O. Scott shows in his new book, Better Living Through Criticism, How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth, is that we are, in fact, all critics. Because critical thinking informs almost every aspect of artistic creation, of civil action, of interpersonal life. Drawing on the long tradition of criticism from Aristotle to Susan Sontag, Scott shows that criticism was and always will be the breath of fresh air that allows true creativity to thrive. A.O. Scott joined the New York Times as a film critic in January of 2000. Previously, he was a Sunday book reviewer for Newsday and a frequent contributor to Slate, the New York Review of Books, and many other publications. It's a great pleasure to welcome A.O. Scott to the roundtable this morning. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm very well. It's great to be here.
Wonderful to have you on the program. I've been a great fan of your work, and I thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
What brought you to the subject of wanting to really take a very close look at what you do for a living?
It was partly that I'd been in the habit of thinking about it for a long time. I think a lot of people who are critics occasionally will write a column or an essay or a think piece about what we do, or how it's misunderstood, why everyone who complains about us gets it wrong. But I was kind of inspired to look more closely by a few things. One was that a few years ago I started to notice that there were a lot of predictions of my immediate extinction, and that all of the people who do what I do for a living were gonna, you know, all fade away into obscurity, and that it was mostly good riddance, you know, that in the age of Amazon algorithms and social media and Yelp and Rotten Tomatoes, no one was going to need critics anymore. And I thought, well, is that true? And other than, you know, then the loss to me of a job that I enjoy very much, would it even matter? So I set out to kind of figure out not only what critics do, and to defend not only the profession of criticism as I practice it, but also to look a little deeper and think about, well, why does criticism exist? What is the function of it? To what extent are we all doing it? Is it a part of our lives and our experiences in culture and in society? And I kind of wanted to write. I found myself writing more about that, more about the activity of criticism than about the job of critics.
What do you think it is about? Let's talk about the job of a critic for a moment, and then go deeper. And that is, what do you think your role is and has been throughout journalistic history of why we go to see what you have to say about a particular piece of art?
I think that you know, critics are often thought of as judges and sometimes also executioners. When a work of art, a book or a film or a painting or whatever comes out into the world, into the marketplace, the critics are there to evaluate it and to say what it's worth, whether it's worth anybody's time, where it fits on the scale of achievement. I think of it a little differently. I see my own job as, in a way, to begin and to some extent to guide a conversation about these works of art. I mean, I think that critics, we always start from our own experience, from our own point of view. I went to see a movie, and it made me laugh, it made me cry, it bored me, it offended me, and I'm taking that experience as kind of the raw material for an argument. I'm trying to take what is subjective and sometimes emotional and turn it into an evaluation, turn it into a piece of writing that other people can use to help them decide what they want to do with their time, and also maybe more importantly, to encourage and help other people think about the movie that they've seen, in my case, after they've seen it.
As you mentioned just a moment ago, the book is less a defense of the status of professional critics than an examination of criticism. What do you think it is important? Because you make, obviously, you start off by making the point that we are all critics. So with that in mind, what is a good starting point for us to understand the responsibility we have?
I think the responsibility is, first of all, to be open-minded. I think that it's very easy for us to get kind of caught up in our own prejudices, our own habits of mind, to take a narrow view of our own taste. And I think that a lot of the technology that surrounds us encourages this. You know, that you have your Netflix queue that's telling you, you know, you watch this, so now you might want to watch that. Your Amazon algorithm says, you know, people who bought this also bought that. And you can come to think of yourself as a certain type of person. Well, I like these kinds of, I don't like romantic comedies. I don't like action movies. I don't like foreign films. I don't like hip hop, whatever it is. And I think one thing that I argue for in the book is that we have the ability, and I think to some degree the responsibility, to to jump the tracks of our own taste and our own prejudices, to open our minds, to be adventurous, to go where our curiosity leads us, not to be afraid of new or strange or difficult or challenging experiences, and I think that that's very important. I think we also, it's important to be kind of active, not to be just passive consumers of art and entertainment and culture. It's very easy to be lulled into a kind of passivity, to go see the blockbuster movie or watch the popular television show, and to kind of be carried along on this tide of publicity and marketing and advertising and hype. One thing that I hope is that, and believe, is that we should be more active. We should kind of take control of our own experiences and really think about them. And part of the pleasure that art and popular culture offer us is the pleasure of thinking about what they mean and arguing about why they matter.
So in that role of being more active, are we doing it for us, or should we be doing it for us to fully understand and to have a more active role in the conversation that we're having with the piece of art? Or should we also, in doing that, want to share the opinion with others?
I think both. I think one of the fascinating things about art, about movies and books and all the rest of it, is that it's simultaneously an individual subjective experience. You know, we sit alone in the dark looking at watching a movie, and it's almost like our own personal dream. But at the same time, it is a social and a communal experience. That is, you know, we may be there with our friends. We may actually be at the movies alone. But nonetheless, you know, there are other people around and other people sharing in this experience. And I think one of the things that criticism is the transition from the solitary to the social. We've had this experience and we want to share it, we want to talk about it, we want to compare it, we want to argue about it. So for me, I always think of criticism as beginning in the conversation that you have with your friends after you're leaving the movie, you know, and someone says, "Oh man, that was great," and someone else says, "Well, what are you, crazy? That was terrible. That was the worst movie I've ever seen." And then the conversation that follows from that that difference of opinion, or even sometimes from an agreement, when you talk about, you know, all the things that were so wonderful in that movie, that's criticism. That's the kind of the sharing of this experience that we've had. So it is for me a social activity. I mean, I sit alone and write, but I hope that, you know, people will come along and read, and that I can kind of take the noise in my own head and turn it into something that's of interest to somebody else.
In turning it around in your head and having that and sort of propelling the conversation for us, and I assume you hear this a lot, that people read, at least I assume this is the case, because I read you twice. I read you before I see the movie, and I read you after I've seen the movie.
Yeah.
So that is in doing that, you have an idea of what the film is about, then you see the film, and then you can have a more informed discussion when I actually read your review and see what you have to say about it. Because sometimes I can get very angry. Sometimes I can be quite jubilant in my understanding that we have that in common. And how healthy is that overall to go about that process?
Well, I think I'm always kind of writing for both sides of the experience. I mean, the review comes out the day that the movie opens in New York, so I'm very, careful not to spoil the plot if I can manage that. And that I'm writing partly for people who are going to who are going to read before they see the movie, or may read and decide not to see the movie. And then also hoping that at the other end of the experience, someone will come out of it and read to compare notes, to in a way keep the experience going, to keep the pleasure of thinking going. And the disagreements do happen, because we're all different. We're all coming at this from different points of view. And what I hope for myself from readers, and what I as a reader look for in the critics who I read, is not so much agreement as trust. I think it's my job, my obligation to my readers, to be as honest and transparent as I can be about my own thoughts and my own ideas, and present them as clearly and as cogently as I can, so that the readers know where I'm coming from. So that even if we do disagree, it won't seem just entirely kind of arbitrary or offensive, but will make some sense. And I feel the same way. I mean, there are writers and critics who I read faithfully, who I almost never agree with, but who I find valuable to read, because in kind of measuring the distance between their taste and mine, and understanding the differences of between our points of view, I've learned something maybe about myself and about how I relate to the film or the piece of music or the other work of art in question.
A.O. Scott is our guest. The new book, Better Living Through Criticism, How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. He is the chief film critic at the New York Times, as well as being a distinguished professor of film criticism at Wesleyan University. As far as the opportunities that you mentioned early on in our discussion, Rotten Tomatoes and Yahoo and Google and various places where you can provide your review, that just anyone who sees the film, or maybe even hasn't seen the film, can comment in those sections. Do you feel that serves a purpose? Is that a good thing?
I think that it mostly is. I mean, it can be overwhelming. It can certainly be obnoxious. There's a lot of opinion flying around on the internet, and not all of it is very elegantly expressed or carefully thought through. But in a way, that's nothing new. I mean, I think that the platform is certainly new, but I think, in a way, it's always been going on. One thing I discovered as I was researching this book is I was reading some of the recent complaints that people have about the internet and about social media, about how noisy it is, how there are all these people kind of popping off with unsupported opinions and no credentials and no basis for what they're saying. And I found that people had been making the same complaints certainly about, you know, about television and radio, and then even before that in the 18th and 19th centuries about print, about all of these pamphlets and magazines and newspapers and that were full of unsupported, often anonymous, irresponsible opinions. So in a way, it's nothing new. I think it's also what social media represents to me is a kind of a making literal of something that's been going on for a very long time. I mean, people have been you know, expressing their opinions either you know, in the privacy of their own heads or to anyone in earshot, you know, at the bar or in the classroom or on the street for a very long time. Now we have this other venue where all that can take place, which, as I say, can be overwhelming, can be noisy, can be chaotic, but I think is also very exciting and democratic. I like having all of these other voices out there. I like knowing that people are reading. I'm old enough to remember, you know, just how lonely it used to be to publish something in a newspaper or magazine and have the kind of silence where you wondered, well, is anyone out there? Is anybody listening? And occasionally, you know, you get a handwritten letter weeks later. And now, you know, you can go on Twitter into the comments section, and it's like, oh, wow, people are reading. And, you know, they don't always like what I have to say, but but I'm kind of happy to know about it.
You write in the book that with this tabulation of Yelp scores or Rotten Tomatoes metrics, what it can tell us is if they're right. And you say, the individual critic, I will admit, is not much more trustworthy. Being a statistical sample of one, he or she stands a very good chance of being overruled, corrected, or outvoted by the verdicts of history, public taste, or common sense. This is not an accident or a flaw in the system by which aesthetic values are produced or transmitted, but rather a feature that is crucial to the system's functioning. It is, in other words, the job of critics to be wrong. It is the one job we can actually reliably do. How soon does it take for you to know that you were wrong?
You know, sometimes it's 10 or 15 minutes. I mean, I don't, you know, people at least will come in and say I'm wrong. I tend to like to kind of, to not admit when I think I've been wrong, because I kind of believe in letting the record stand. But it sometimes can take many years. I mean, one of the examples I use in the chapter that you were just reading from is one of my predecessors at the New York Times, Frank Nugent, wrote a very dismissive review in 1938 of Bringing Up Baby, which was just about as kind of offhand and dismissive and contemptuous as some of the reviews that I've written, say, of recent Adam Sandler movies. He just said, this is full of cliches, it's a crazy, zany comedy, you know, I was bored, and he's done with it in four paragraphs. And of course, it's Bringing Up Baby, which is one of the great classic screwball comedies of that era. And it also didn't do that well at the box office. You know, the public was not much crazier about it than the reviewer was. And then, you know, over time, that judgment comes to seem ridiculous. You know, how could you say Bringing Up Baby, one of the most delightful comedies, you know, that the Hollywood studio system ever turned out, with you know, Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn and a leopard in Connecticut, was you know, kind of just a run of the mill you know, piece of junk. So that comes to look spectacularly wrong. And I was very interested in, like, well, you know, how does that happen? Why does that happen? And it's fascinating to me when it does. And I do think that the guy, you know, Frank Nugent, was doing his job. He was calling it the way he saw it. And it was for later generations to come along and say, you know what, that guy didn't know what he was talking about.
You wrote a column at the end of last year, Oscars 2016 and the nominees should be. And it's a list of all of the critics and what they think would be Best Picture. You pick five. And out of those five, two were actually nominated.
So what I'm curious about is how do awards and how do specifically the Oscars fit into this equation, and are they any more are they a better arbiter of merit than what you do on a weekly basis in the film pages of the New York Times?
Well, I think I'm not only, you know, saying this to be self-serving. I think they're a much, much worse arbiter of merit. I think that, you know, there's plenty of historical evidence of that, of you know, Oscars ignoring movies that have gone on to be embraced as classics and rewarding movies that have been quickly
dismissed,
forgotten. Yeah. But I think it's partly because the Oscars, you know, exist. They're a creature of the film industry. You know, it's an elite stratum of 6,000 Hollywood professionals voting on the works of their peers, and also voting to project a kind of an image of what they do and an ideal of prestige. And of artistic merit that really has nothing to do, or nothing necessarily to do, with the actual quality of movies. So there are all kinds of movies that they tend to ignore or to overlook. A great example, certainly in recent years, and for a very long time, being comedies. You know, certainly in the performing categories. You know, what you have to do to get an Oscar nomination and to win an Oscar as an actor or an actress is to suffer, you know, and to endure terrible, terrible suffering. And that, in the Academy's mind, is what, you know, equates to seriousness, which is what, you know, distinguishes great performances. But I don't think that's true. I think that there are, you know, many great comic performances that are certainly as difficult and you know, much more memorable than the kind of suffering and weeping and wailing that tends to win Oscars. So I think that the Academy takes a very narrow view of the art form in a way. And I think you know, what they say, what they think of as the best, is in a way what they think will reflect the best on their industry, but that doesn't necessarily represent the best achievements in the art.
The book is fascinating. It's Better Living Through Criticism, and it's published by Penguin Press. A.O. Scott, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
It was great talking with you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.